The Skinflint podcast brought to you by Nextmune UK, a specialist in veterinary dermatology and immunotherapy in association with elearning.vet.
Hello and welcome to the Skinflint podcast, another edition of the podcast dedicated to dermatology in companion animals. And today we're going to turn our attention to the equine side. For the first time on Skinflint, we're being joined by an amazing guest, Derek Nottenbelt, who's also known as Notty. So this edition is called Notty Another Sarcoid, because we're going to be talking about sarcoids today. And just to say off the bat that this podcast is, as I say, it's equine specific, but there's always learning there. So if you're not on the equine side, but you have some dealings with that, then do, yeah, listen along. It's also, there's some technical language in there. So as ever, remember that we have show notes. So you can actually follow the podcast along with the show notes, if that maybe helps, like me, follow along with some of the things that I might get lost on otherwise. But yeah, to introduce to you my the hosts of this podcast as ever, well, we've got three sarcoids sitting on the side of a horse here hosting, and that the horse is the Skinflint podcast itself. The first sarcoid is yours truly, who everybody would probably like Derek Nottenbelt to kind of get rid of, really. I am John Rebond, and host and dermatology nurse of this thing. And then, as ever, of course, we're joined by everybody's favorite sarcoid, the sarcoid of all sarcoids, the European leading dermatologist sarcoid, Dr. Sue Patterson. Hello, Sue.
Hi, John. And I've been called many things in my life, but never a sarcoid. And welcome, everybody. It's lovely to join us again. Fresh back, actually, from the most fantastic European Dermatology Congress in Porto last week, which was really, really great to meet lots and lots of people. And what was great, John, you'll be delighted to know, is there's loads of people out there in Europe listening to our podcast. So hello to all you people out there. What was really interesting was someone actually said to me, is John really that funny in real life? And I said to them, no, it's just all scripted. So forget that. So, so yeah, it's great to be here again. And I have to say, it's taken me a little bit of work to tie him down, but I am looking forward to chatting to Derek. He is incredible. He's passionate. He's knowledgeable. He is Mr. Sarcoid, to be honest with you. He's very, very shy when it comes to, you know, shining his own banner, if you will, because he's enormously qualified, enormously experienced. He's actually an OBE for services to equine medicine. So wow. He will be the most fantastic guest. I'm really excited to chat to him in just a minute.
Wow. Oh, brilliant. Yeah. Well, that's really whetted the appetite. Thank you, Sue. So yeah, the second sarcoid on this horse is the sarcoid that keeps all the other sarcoids seamlessly connected by predominantly video and audio based education platforms. That is the sarcoid Mr. Paul Heesman, who's probably right now gutted that somebody has encouraged my banter on this podcast.
May I just say, Sue, that John actually called me after you told him this to tell me this feedback as well. It was very excitable. So please, to our listeners, please stop encouraging this so much. But no, it's really looking forward to this one today. And kudos to Sue for booking such a fantastic speaker. Really looking forward to it. I hope you all enjoy it too.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, let's bring him in then. Let's go over and bring in Derek Nottenbelt.
So I am so excited today because I've been tracking this gentleman down for an awful long time, and I'm chuffed to bits that we have Professor Derek Nottenbelt, who's joining us today to talk about one of his favourite subjects, which is sarcoid. So Derek, thank you so much for taking the time to join us. I know how enormously busy you are with all your work. For those people who've been living down a dark hole who don't know who you are, would you just like briefly to introduce yourself to our audience?
Yeah, thank you very much for inviting me to this, by the way, and I'm very pleased to be able to do this and try to share some of my thoughts with people. I've been a practitioner primarily, and then became an academic, and then gradually, as my academic career developed at Liverpool, climbed the inevitable ladder to a professorial position, from which I retired in 2010. So that finished me off, and then I set up Equine Medical Solutions to try to provide practitioners with some advice and help. So I'm really just a practitioner because I pride myself in being more practical than theoretical. I'm not a scientist, so that's me, and that's how I am. Yep.
And Derek, you've just hugely undersold yourself. You are hugely qualified. You're a diplomat in the European College of Equine Internal Medicine and the American College of Veterinary Internal Medicine, and recognised as a world authority on sarcoid. So, thank you. We really appreciate you chatting to us today. let's start the ball rolling, though. First of all, and I know it's a subject that's very dear to your heart, and I know you have probably advised thousands, if not millions, of vets about it over the years. So, sarcoid. Start off just by telling me, what's a sarcoid?
Well, sarcoid is a reactive skin tumor. That's the best way of looking at it. It's best viewed as a form of skin cancer, because if we saw what happens with a sarcoid on any other species, we would automatically assume that it was a neoplastic disorder. And I think that's where the biggest problem has come, because historically it's always been viewed as a viral disease like a papilloma. And because of the relationship to the bovine papillomavirus, it's been belittled, really, I suppose, in a way. The interesting thing about the sarcoid is that it is best viewed as a neoplastic disorder with a viral etiopathogenesis. And I don't really want to do that, because maybe we'll discuss a little bit more about that later on. But it's a multi-morphology skin tumor affecting horses, donkeys, mules, zebras, onagers, and Abyssinian asses, interestingly enough. So all equid species are liable to the disease, and it continues to challenge us clinically and theoretically and scientifically as well.
So if it's a cancer, therefore, by definition, it's not something that's contagious. It's not something that can be spread between horses.
Therein lies one of the biggest problems of all. It is my contention that it is a transmissible disease, and we have definitive evidence for this. Well, I suppose not really definitive, but circumstantial evidence where outbreaks of the disease have occurred in stable yards subsequent to the importation or the development of a single case into the stable yard. And so we believe that it is a disease which it multiplies over the summer and grows over the winter, and it is transmissible from horse to horse to some extent, although the actual mechanism for this is very unclear at the moment. It doesn't behave like a viral disease, but also it doesn't behave like a genuine neoplastic disease, because there are no mutational aspects to it. It's something to do with the bovine papillomavirus or a part thereof.
So potentially biting flies, spreading virus between horses, is that what you would suggest is happening?
Oh, absolutely. I think that they're looking at where sarcoids develop. There are sites where sarcoids are more prevalent, more common, of course, such as the armpit, the axilla, the side of the face, the base of the ear, the groin, the sheath, places like this, and of course wounds. And when you look at where sarcoids occur, there are common features about them. And that firstly is that the skin is thin. Flies can feed there with impunity. They don't get rejected from them. There's no hair cover. They sweat. And of course, it is areas which are liable to minor skin trauma from fly bites. And this is where flies feed. So it's not actually the biting flies that transmit the disease, in spite of a recent publication that was made recently concerning the finding of bovine papillomavirus genomic component, let me put it like that, in Stomoxys flies. But I don't believe it's the biting fly that transmits the disease. I believe that the disease is best viewed as transmissible by a surface feeding fly that then feeds on a sarcoid, and then somehow or another, through some mechanism as yet unclear, although I have my own hypothesis about it, transfers the sarcoid element into a site of skin trauma of some description. Now, that does not have to be a big trauma. It can be a needle puncture, for example, or even the single fly bite of a biting fly. But no biting flies ever feed on a sarcoid, and no surface feeding flies ever feed on a blood vessel. So, you know, it's not quite the same thing. So there's some sort of a relationship between this that has to be yet established.
And that's really interesting, because if you look at those nuisance flies then that feed on discharge, that might go some way to explaining why, for example, you get periocular sarcoids, because you've got those sorts of flies feeding around the faces of horses and therefore spreading infection. That would fit nicely, wouldn't it?
Yes. Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. And you hit the nail right on the head. I mean, you know, the problem is that when you get sarcoids in those kind of well-recognized sites where surface feeding flies go, it's entirely understandable. And then you say, well, where else do they occur? And where sarcoids are rare spontaneously, they are always associated with wounds. And that is on the distal limb, for example, and on the upper body part where the skin is very thick and very well covered with hair. We don't get sarcoids in those sites under normal circumstances. There is always a wound or some form of cutaneous abrasion, irritation, inflammation. Something happens in these areas to attract whatever it is that brings it, presumably flies and surface feeding flies. And always use the analogy that surface feeding flies are like teenagers going to McDonald's. You know, the food is greasy, disgusting, sweet, warm, available 24/7 at almost no cost. So surface feeding flies flock to these sites of skin inflammation, and sarcoid is one of those. Whereas biting flies are like Richard Branson. He would never dream of going to McDonald's. He goes to a 5-star Michelin restaurant and eats with the fine wine. So that's where biting flies feed. And of course, the hooligans go there afterwards and they take a pub drink, and that's how they're just transmitted. It's a stupid analogy, I know, but it just fits the epidemiology of the disease. And something relating to a virus per se blowing around on the wind just doesn't fit the epidemiology of this disease at all, not even at all. So if they're in contact with cattle and so on and so forth, the bovine papillomavirus is certainly involved, but it is a question of what part of this virus and how that is linked to the development of particular sarcoids in particular sites.
So, Derek, I love that analogy. And I'm always happy for a stupid analogy because, well, I'm stupid, among other things. And I'm trying to hang in there with some of the technical terms here. What we're dealing with then, if you can correct me if I'm wrong in my summary, is this is basically a lump that forms on horse or horsey species that is a developmental tumor. So it pops up because, and I'm getting the sense that this is because these flies tend to transfer this virus around, and then as a result, there are particular areas on the horse that this is prone to. Am I following correctly?
Yes. Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. That is exactly what happens. And the fact is that the vast majority of these sarcoids, the sarcoids on a horse, I mean, you have to remember that, you know, in round about 1985 or so, when I did my first survey, perhaps a little earlier than that, we found that there were 2.5% of British horses had sarcoids, and they had 2.5 sarcoids each. On average, I mean, an average doesn't mean anything. If you put one of your legs in the freezer at minus 40, and you put one of your legs in the oven at 200, on average, you're very comfortable. So averages don't necessarily mean a lot, but it is an important index of what the disease is and how important it is. And now, the later survey that I did in 2009 showed that there were nearly 8% of horses affected by it in the United Kingdom, in some areas that I was testing. Of course, there may be differences locally, but of those, the average was just under 24 sarcoids per horse. So you can see that this is a disease which is gradually becoming more and more prevalent, and the incidence is increasing year on year. And certainly that's my experience.
Yeah, so it's definitely something that any horse owners or horse vets, they need to be very aware of and thinking about and tracking with, you know, the thoughts on it as it develops. Are there any particular breeds of horse or ages or any sort of predispositions, as they say?
You raise a very good point. Right, originally there were initial studies that involved very low numbers of horses where they felt that the quarter horse was less liable to it and the standard bred was perhaps a little bit more, but the thoroughbred was more liable to it. And so people started looking and to try and see what linked the susceptible breeds. And I don't know that there's a breed that's completely resistant to it. And I think I've seen sarcoid in pretty much every breed that is available. And I just don't think that it is as simple as that. I think there are genes that impart susceptibility to the disease, which seem to be an important issue because we do have familial outbreaks of it where, you know, the whole family of horses has been very liable to the disease and they continue to get the disease in sequential generations. So there are genetic tendencies toward it. And then, of course, you say, well, if they're genetic tendencies and familial things, then there have to be some breed susceptibilities. And sure, I suppose there are, but they're very difficult to establish. And then, of course, from the age perspective, I was always told, there's one paper which said, much of the current dogma is that it's a disease of the young horse. But we did 29,000. We were trying to get 30,000, but we didn't quite get there. But we just analyzed the age of first onset for something just under 30,000 horses, which I think is a decent study in veterinary medicine anyway. And we didn't find anything. It just mimicked the population of horses. So, of course, there are a lot of relatively young horses which are looked at more frequently, examined more frequently for purchase and so on and so forth. And a lot more attention is paid to them. But the oldest horse I've had, a de novo sarcoid, is 40, and the youngest I've had was 17 days old. So I am not convinced by age. I'm convinced by environment and exposure and circumstance. And then, of course, if you want to superimpose the genetic liability of a particular family or a particular breed or a particular group of horses could be involved. So that's breed, age, sex. There was a study which said geldings were more liable to it, but over our complete study, and that's a lot more than 30,000 now, I do not see any sex-related prevalence of this disease. I just don't think it has anything to do with it at all. So that's breed, sex, and age. And then color is the last thing, of course, from any normal signalment of the horse. I hate the word, but anyway, it's a description of the horse. The color, some people say gray horse is more liable, but that's not my experience. I think every single horse is at least potentially, provided they have the genes for susceptibility. Now, there are certainly individual horses that do not get the disease under any circumstances. And we don't know why that is. And it may be a very interesting group of horses to study in comparison to those that get a lot of disease. And of course, that's a scientific study. I'm not a scientist. I'm just a practitioner in disguise, I suppose. And so I will leave this for more erudite people than me.
And what I think is really great, Derek, is that when you're producing data, it's really rich data. So often we see publications in veterinary journals where we've got very small numbers, but when you're quoting 30,000 horses plus, I think it gives an awful lot of weight to that publication, which is so useful for practitioners who are out there. And so we talked about the etiology, which I think is really, really interesting, really thought-provoking. Let's talk about sarcoids themselves. And I think one of the biggest challenges for identification of sarcoids for both horse owners and for vets and for dermatologists and for specialists is what sarcoids look like, because there are so many different clinical presentations of a sarcoid. So just walk me through, if you will, for our listeners, the different forms of sarcoid that you recognize, and perhaps talk about some of the differentials that we need to consider, or if indeed there are differentials for some of those presentations.
Yeah, well, I think what you raised is an important point. And right originally, when I started looking at this disease, I was struck by the misdiagnosis. And it's the first case would ever really brought up to me. I'd been qualified for about 6 or 7 months. And it appeared that this horse had been treated for ringworm and had been treated by the owner for ringworm for up to 4 years. And I just thought, that doesn't correspond to what I was taught at college. I didn't have any experience then to back it up with, but I didn't understand that that could happen, that you could have such a chronic, long-standing thing. And then I started looking at this and think, well, this is not the same thing. And when you look histologically at them, you realize that the sarcoid is a tumor of fibroblasts. It's not a tumor of epithelial cells, keratinocytes. It's a tumor of fibroblasts. And then you ask yourself, what's the relationship? And then you start understanding why there's such a wide range of morphological appearance. You know, these things have a very wide phenotypic expression. So a sarcoid starts out as being a small hairless area with a tiny little, sometimes palpable little dot in the middle of it, which you can feel if you run the skin through your fingers. And you see the circular area. Well, what is the circular area? Circular area of an occult sarcoid is just keratinocytes that are behaving badly and hair follicles that are behaving badly. And you say to yourself, well, how on earth is that related to fibroblast tumor activity? Because when you look histologically at them, you can find this. And you can find that the dermoepidermal junction has a very characteristic palisaded picket fence appearance histologically. So we know that the disease is there and we know that it has this effect. But the question is, what is the tumor and what is the secondary consequence of it? What is the paracrine effect of having a tumor that has a viral genome inserted into its structure? In other words, it expresses mediators that alter the behavior of the surrounding cells. So the earliest form of the sarcoid is usually the occult form. But remember that the occult margin or the occult appearance is not actually the tumor. It may contain the tumor, of course, and of course, multiple focuses within it can easily exist. So that's the first one. That's the very mildest form, usually circular. Why? Because all these mediators and so on diffuse outward from the center. It's a lot more complicated than that, but just simplistically, that's an easy way of looking at it. It diffuses out and runs out, but it is not the tumor. Then, of course, gradually this little central area starts producing more and more behavioral change and becomes faster dividing, more aggressive, more dermoepidermal, and starts producing hyperkeratosis. And now we get what looks like a wart now. So now we're getting this. But the question is that a wart? Well, no, it isn't, because it's not a papilloma, which starts out on the skin and continues and produces a fibrous vascular pedicle or a blood supply to it as a secondary event. This is a tumor which is changing the cells in the immediate vicinity. And that's a much better way of looking at it. So as soon as we do that, we now have what's called the varicose or wart-like tumor. So that's the second stage, if you will, in the progression of the disease. Then we have to divide the next stage up into two categories. One is the nodular form, which occurs in two types. One is at what I call a type A nodule, where there is no skin involvement. In other words, this is a hard fibrous mass, usually spherical, as you would imagine if it starts out as one cell and starts to expand in much the same way as an embryo does. It starts out as one cell and multiplies into a little ball. Well, now we've got a little ball of what cells? Fibroblast. But because there's a separation between this and the skin, there's no involvement of the overlying skin at all. So there's no evidence of varicose or secondary paracrine changes in the epidermis itself. So this is then subcutaneous. So now that's a type A nodule. Then there's a type B nodule, where it's attached to the skin and you can't move the skin over the surface. Now, this is quite a different situation because you usually have these paracrine effects developing in the overlying skin because it's attached to it. People often ask, how's this happened? Well, if I take a cell or a particle and I drop it subcutaneously away from the skin itself in the dermis or below, we are going to get a nodule. and it may or may not involve the skin on the surface. But if I drop it in the dermoepidermal region right between, then I'm going to get a nodule, but I'm also going to get skin involvement because it can't detach itself from the tooth. And that's going to have a paracrine effect. So that's the type A and B nodules. Now, these are very easy to identify, and they're very characteristic and very common in a lot of horses, and they can get myriads of these things on them at any one time. Then, of course, you have the fibroblastic form, which is the fleshy form, which is the form we really fear probably most of all, because it's a very aggressive, vascularized, ulcerated, infected, usually infected tumor, which is quite obvious on the outside. And of course, it looks, this case, it looks like granulation tissue. There's lots of things that look like granulation tissue, but sarcoid looks like it in this form. Going back to the others, wart-like, varicose could be wart-like. And then the occult form has its own set of differentials. So, you know, ringworm, as I said before, which was the first case I ever got interested in, was exactly that. Or pemphigus or alopecia areata, things that produce circular areas of hair loss with some scaling and stuff like this on the surface. So you can see each one of these types has its own set of differential diagnoses. The fibroblastic one could be any number of other tumors, including fibrosarcoma. And that's why pathologists often diagnose sarcoid as low-grade fibrosarcomas, and they don't really like calling it sarcoid unless there's a dermoepidermal junctional change, and therefore they classify it as something a little bit different. But usually most of those, and most of the neurofibromas and so on that have developed and been described, are actually just sarcoid.
So Derek, when we're talking about these different forms, what causes the transition from one form to another? And on that basis, should we biopsy these?
Right. Well, what causes this progression, that what I would classify as tumor progression, really, towards a very malignant form at the end, which is the sixth form, of course. But the first thing that does it is chronology, the age of the tumor, the duration of the tumor, because there is a gradual but sequential progression. But if you want to hasten that progression, you just have to traumatize the lesion to any extent whatsoever. So that trauma can be almost anything. It can be persistent rubbing from a harness or a blanket or a rug or a buckle on the cheek of the horse or the front of the breast of the horse where the buckles sit. And it rubs and rubs and rubs and rubs. Or it's trauma from the girth, for example. Say we've got a little sarcoid on the girth, and the girth goes on and is tightened and then is jiggled and rubbed and compressed. That causes progression. And then there's the natural progression, or the natural trauma or manipulation of any particular tumor by the natural movement of the horse. So sarcoids that occur, for example, on the medial thigh, on the high medial thigh over the stifle, are stretched and compressed and massaged with every single step the horse takes. Same applies to the axilla, for example. And so ultimately, these areas are, you know, really important to remember that there are natural things which happen which are not traumatic that are going to cause this exacerbation, simply because you should not massage a tumor. If you ever find a tumor on yourself, for goodness sake, don't massage it. You know, that's because that's bad news for any tumor. And so don't traumatize it either. And so, of course, now comes to your answer. Should you or could you biopsy these things safely? Well, you can only biopsy them safely if you have a plan as to what to do immediately afterwards. You don't have any plan, and you just want to know if it's a sarcoid. But if it's a sarcoid, I'm going to leave it. And if it's not a sarcoid, I'm still going to leave it. So why bother? Because trauma of any description will exacerbate this. And I did a little study many years ago. Unfortunately, the statistics were not up to much, and I've got to try to view this again. But we had horses where they had two sarcoids of a similar type, broadly similar type, one of which had been either biopsied or had been partially excised without a safe margin. So we had this, and we had 180 horses in this group of animals, and we tested the untreated, unbiopsied, uninterfered one against the interfered with one, that biopsy or the trauma, because it comes down to the same thing, I suppose, in a way, if you don't set out to remove the whole tumor or you're not successful in doing so. And we found that over 85% of these horses showed significant exacerbation, both in terms of the extent, the rate of growth, and the type of sarcoid.
Next Mune brings you Contigo, a high-purity hypochlorous acid skin spray with 96% hypochlorous content and no sodium hypochlorite. With strong antiseptic properties, Contigo can help manage wounds, cuts, abrasions, and other skin damage without irritating the skin or interfering with wound healing. Contigo from Next Mune UK.
Yeah, and I think that's a really good point on a practical front, Derek, to say, well, look, there's no point in biopsying it to find out what it is if that's going to exacerbate the problem. If actually that's not going to change what you do anyway.
Yeah, exactly right.
And so I suppose that leads us nicely on to thinking about, well, what do you do with a sarcoid? And so what treatments, and I suppose really we want to get the top end really of what you feel the treatments are, the options are, which you would go for yourself when approaching sarcoid.
Right. I think that there are the criteria that we would try to use when we're deciding what treatments we should use should be tempered by what we can use and what is available to us and what facilities and so on we have. So the first thing you have to remember is that the treatment of different types of sarcoid is going to be different. So some treatments apply to early lesions. You can imagine that, for example, a 5% 5-fluorouracil or a 10% 5-fluorouracil ointment applied to a very superficial varicose sarcoid on the side of the face is good. So you may want to say, well, that's not working quite so hard, and we'll just go for imiquimod, for example, and we'll try with that. So you can see that superficial lesions require much less intervention. They're still dangerous because if you don't get them, if you don't cure them, then they're coming back and they're coming back spitting mad. And that's what my study showed, that they don't like being interfered with. And therefore, you have to have this singular determination to say, if this doesn't work, we are going to do that. And if that doesn't work, we're going to do that. Just in the same way as cancer is treated in all other species, but the horse is exempt from all conventional wisdom for some bizarre reason and has its own dogma, which is associated with it. So for the early lesions, we would try to treat them with superficial things. You can do a little cryosurgery. You can actually do a laser surgery or a surgical excision, provided that if you do any form of surgery whatsoever, the surgical specimen is submitted for histological confirmation of a safe margin. The diagnosis is not the issue. The diagnosis is made. I mean, we can make that diagnosis clinically by just simply looking at these lesions for the most part, not every case by any manner of means. And so biopsy is sometimes very helpful. But once we've got the diagnosis, what matters? And people say, well, I know it's a sarcoid, I'm just going to remove it surgically. So, well, you know, how do you know you've got it all? You know, have you got the whole tumor? Because if you haven't got the whole tumor, you have to go back and do something else. So this idea that you can cut off a sarcoid, throw it in the waste bin, or more particularly throw it to a Jack Russell to eat, you know, this kind of behavior is just not acceptable to me in any sense of the word. And I think it's professionally irresponsible. The surgical pathology protects the surgeon. The surgical pathology protects the horse. It protects the owner. And it is the right and proper professional thing to do. What we find is that a lot of people ask, you know, the owner, do you want to know what it is? You know, that's not the point. The owner is not qualified to know whether the horse needs the surgical pathology or not, you see. So this is the surgical hang-ups that go with a surgical removal or laser surgical removal. And increasingly, the surgical options are becoming more sophisticated. And as soon as you get sophistication involved with surgery, you get gadgets involved with it. And as soon as you get gadgets involved, you get investment. And as soon as you get investment, you find that you have a machine that looks for a job, not a job looking for a machine.
And Derek, I couldn't agree with you more. I can't see any point in taking a lump off anything, whether it's a horse, a dog, a cat, a goat, or a guinea pig, and not sending it off for histopathology. Absolutely. I think that's just needs to be done. But let me just give you two scenarios. So if we use a gorgeous CO2 laser or a diode laser, and we take this sarcoid off, two scenarios. A, we've got good margins. What's the prognosis and how do you follow that up? B, you've not completely removed it. Scenarios, how do you manage that and what are the prognosis for that? So just give me those two as final thoughts.
Okay, so a surgical removal that is pretty much certain to have resolved the issue, in other words, that you've got a safe margin, is a good basic point from which to start. Unfortunately, the surgical pathology does not detect everything. And seeding of the sarcoid is probably the biggest danger of all. And that is where tumor cells, which are released by the surgeon during the procedure, either because you take a swab and you put a swab on and you transfer the cell back into the site, those are not detected histologically. So I never trust any surgical intervention until the site has closed. So we'll assume that your surgery now closes completely, then you can safely leave that alone. You should remember, however, that the scar becomes liable to seeding with sarcoid from fly attack. And that's very much more common than people think. And for the first year after the removal, that scar remains fragile and liable to seeding from an outside source. So you can get seeded sarcoid. Now, if you don't get a safe margin, what is going to be the consequence? Well, firstly, you're going to get what I call deep root recurrence. Now, deep root recurrence starts because you haven't got the whole tumor and it's going to start deep and work its way to the surface. So by the time you actually see it, the tumor is going to be twice as big deep to the visible portion than it is visible. So now you have to say to yourself, if the margin is not safe, how can you enhance the response? How can you sharpen that? Well, there are lots of things that you can do, and I'm a great fan of concurrent or multimodal treatment. I try to use multimodal treatment as much as I can. And following surgery, this means using either some immunological methods, such as immunocidin or even BCG or even radiation, or you say, I'm going to use some local chemotherapy. Some things are more practical than others, and some are more available to individual people involved in this condition. So all of those can be tied in and say, well, I've only got carboplatin. That's what I've got. So can I make that into a slow release emulsion? Can I use a carboplatin bead, a biodegradable bead? Can I inject it with the aqueous carboplatin? The problem with the injection of aqueous solutions is that they wash out within 30 seconds of the injection. There is no detectable material present. And this concept has rather been ignored in when we're talking about electrochemotherapy or all these kind of things where you're trying to rely on chemotherapy to deal with the cells locally. You have to make sure that you have enough concentration then, so you have to use enormous doses. Same applies to mitomycin C, 5-fluorouracil, all these things. You have to inject an enormous quantity, but you can superimpose on that a number of things. So you've cut off your tumor, you've injected it with a slow release form of, let's say, carboplatin or 5-fluorouracil. Those are the common ones. And then you're saying, well, I'm going to freeze it as well. So you can do some cryosurgery on it as well. That enhances the effect. So what you've got is an additive thing. There's nothing much that's synergistic apart from the chemotherapy and radiation. That is synergistic. But the rest is all additive. So you're adding on a little bit of extra prognosis each time. So instead of having a 60% chance, you raise it to 70% or you raise it to 80%. But you can never be sure with the sarcoid. The only predictable thing about the sarcoid is that it is unpredictable and that there are multiple treatments, 40 different treatments, including topical creams like the AW5, 5-fluorouracil, imiquimod, these kind of things. And then there are some injectable ones. You know, the latest one is Stelfonta, you know, Tignolol Tiglate. Okay, it's a hard word to say, but that's available. And new treatments are coming on all the time. You know, people are developing, instead of BCG, which was difficult to get, we've got a supply of it, which we dispense out and which we can use quite easily. We can get as much as we need, but that's not the same as being freely available, unfortunately, because we've just got a special arrangement that we take on that. But all these kind of things being replaced now in America by immunocidin, incredibly expensive treatment, but also immunological. So you can combine all sorts of different kinds of treatment to get a satisfactory outcome. You can think of photodynamic therapy, you think of intralesional chemotherapy, you think of all these things that go. But the one thing you have to avoid is the nonsense brigade. You know, it's cancer. You know, and if someone is going to rub product X on a cancer on their own body, then I suppose, you know, they are justifying its use in the horse. But if they're not going to put it on their own cancer, then I just don't believe that anyone should do any of these, because there's so much of it about. And you can read the internet. You know, we now know about spontaneous resolution, and that happens between 1% and 63% of horses, depending on which study you look at and over what time scale you're prepared to do it. So it's a rare occurrence, or it's a relatively common occurrence. And so if you can imagine, if you could rub Marmite on it, that's a common thing, or Vegemite in Australia, or toothpaste in the United Kingdom, or turmeric powder or stuff like this, or curry paste or whatever on the lesion. You can imagine that every now and again, there's going to be a horse that just responds. And we know what that pathology is. We just can't trigger it with any degree of reliability. And so if you do that and you get a resolution, it's going to be around the internet in 15 minutes, well, actually in 15 milliseconds usually, for the whole world to know. And then everybody jumps on the bandwagon. And then, of course, the proper treatment is not given. And that postpones the treatment and reduces the prognosis to the point where we can do nothing. And I'm tired of seeing disastrous cases that have been subjected to ridiculous treatments. I sometimes use a much stronger word than that, but I'm going to just call it ridiculous at the moment, because it's not appropriate.
Yeah, thank you, Derek, for pre-editing the language there.
I get overexcited about it, and we don't get a chance to cover all the points in it. But nonetheless, it's a thing which I just think I've been dealing with this now for 52 years pretty well, and I just don't feel we've made any progress at all. Sometimes, you know, I just see these cases. Another one that I'm just looking at on my screen right now, this minute, I'm just thinking, my God, surely not.
Really,
you know. This is the 21st century in United Kingdom.
Yeah.
I can see this and I think to myself, what the hell's been going on here? How come this horse has had vaccinations? You know, even if nothing else, it's had the dental and it's had the farrier, you know, has no one commented to this owner that you can't inject it into its neck because it's just covered in sarcoid? You know, right. You can't pick up its leg because its legs are covered in sarcoids, big, horrible, disgusting things. And now, of course, they want a treatment. No, it's got to be fixed by Christmas, you know. So, you know, the usual thing that Sue is only, well, you're all only too familiar with the same philosophy. Like, it doesn't matter because horses, you know, they heal, of course, and neither do they feel anything. Because, you know, somebody, it was in a court case, and the horse, they said, is the horse suffering? And I said, well, you know, I think it is. And then they said, well, is it? I said, well, in my opinion, it is, because it's got 200 sarcoids on it and they're all bleeding and they're all disgusting and they're all covered in flies and maggots. I said, in my view, that is, said, well, the horse is eating happily, he calls to his mates, he rushes around the field in a normal way and he behaves in a completely normal way. He can't be suffering. You see? So that we've got a problem. We've got a problem here with the defense. When people say that they've got a horse in this state and they accept it, You know, it's just part of the daily life, of the daily grind of horse ownership, where you've got a disgusting thing covered in maggots that's stinking, you know, across the whole yard. And I just don't get it, you know.
Really. But yeah, I mean, I think we've really gotten that impression, Derek, and it's been so fascinating to listen to you talk about these. And what's coming across really loud and clear, because I'll need to wrap us now. It's been a fascinating conversation, but we can't take any more of your time. But what's been really loud and clear is that this is something which affects all horses. And so whether any horse owner or vet needs to really take this seriously. And because it is transferable as well, and growing in its the amount that it's being seen, its prevalence, it's something which they, like you say, they really need to be following the science on this one, and approaching these properly, do things like you were saying, biopsy only if it's gonna, you know, give a proper outcome, and then properly surgically remove with using these treatments in a multimodal, correct, appropriate, evidence-based way, following that as well to try and get the best resolution of these, and hopefully from this amazing conversation, yeah, that really comes across to those listening. So Derek, I'd like to say thank you very much on behalf of Skinflint and the audience for joining us for this conversation. It's been really fascinating, and hopefully we'll get you back at some point in the near future.
And again, and from me, Derek, as well, thank you so much. And perhaps we should just point out to our listeners that if they do have problems, and we're talking about veterinary surgeons now, of course, they can contact you through your app, which is Equine Medical Solutions. So I'm sure you'd be more than happy to help vets manage some of these difficult cases. So thank you so much. It's been brilliant.
It's a pleasure. And thank you very much for inviting me.
Well, that was just an absolutely fascinating conversation, as we seem to have so many on here. And hopefully you all listening, whatever you're doing, washing up, running, enjoyed that as well. It was great to have Derek Nottenbelt, or Notty, on. He's such an interesting person to listen to, Sue, isn't he?
He is incredible. And it was a shame that we only had him for a relatively short period of time. He's an absolute fountain of knowledge. So I really enjoyed it. It was so good to chat to Derek. Yeah, it was good.
Absolutely. And just to say, as ever, that we do have extensive show notes. So there were a few technical words on there. So if you were listening, there was something that you either didn't quite catch, or like me, probably just didn't understand, then do fly to the show notes. And often the technical words are clickable links as well, which will take you somewhere to explain that to you. Also, just to mention as well, the RCVS have the One CPD platform where you can log your CPD. We actually have, if you go onto the show notes, there will be a link at the top that you can click to, which will give you a QR code. If you scan that QR code with your phone, your One CPD app will automatically just log all the information for your Skinflint podcast onto your CPD record. So it really couldn't be easier to log your CPD with that QR code. So do make use of that as well. And please do subscribe as well, because if you subscribe, then every time we release another of these podcasts, your platform will let you know about it. But before we go, as ever, so I'd like to try and get to know Dr. Sue Patterson and Paul Heisman a little bit more. I mean, Notty, Derek's surname, what a fantastic nickname that is. He's got a great surname to generate a fantastic nickname. I was just wondering whether you guys have any sort of decent nicknames. Mine's pretty lame. When I was younger, I was called Pon, which I don't, never really have understood that, to be honest with you, but there you go. How about you, Sue?
I may well regret this, John, I have to say. But I mean, first of all, the first thing I should say is I hate being called Susan. The only person who calls me Susan is my mother, and that's usually when I've done something wrong. So I'm always Sue. And what I tend to do when I put my name up on Zooms or Teams or something, I usually put Sue P, just so people know, because Susan's quite a common name. And so as a result of that, I do tend to get called Soup, just because of the spelling potential mistakes can be made. So I say I will probably regret that, but that's why that's one of my nicknames.
I can't think of any reason why you'd regret that, Soup. So Paul, you?
I've had a few over the years, some repeatable on a public forum, some less so. I think the main one that stuck was when I was younger, my brother was known as Heese, but for Heisman. So I, when I joined senior school, I was known as Mini Hees, but then it got somewhat became somewhat ironic nickname as I grew to 6'3" and was still known as Mini Hees.
Yeah, I always forget how tall you are, Paul, because, you know, I can't really see on a podcast. But thank you both, as ever, for joining me. Soup, Mini Hees, it's a pleasure, as always, hosting Skinflint with you. And thank you all at home for listening. And until next time, we will see you then.
Bye, everybody.
Thanks, everyone. Bye.
The Skinflint podcast brought to you by Nextmune UK, the specialist in veterinary dermatology and immunotherapy in association with elearning.vet.